It is funny about Facebook, because when Jen introduced me to her dad, she goes, "Do you know my dad?" I go, "No, but we're Facebook friends." Isn't that funny? Aren't we living in a weird day and age? Thank you, worship team. Is this too hot? Is it okay? The Lord was still speaking to me in my notes. I was jotting notes through the worship set. It was exactly what we needed, and I'm really thankful for that. I'm excited that there's so many different churches here. I know Ana Gomez is here with her ladies. Will you raise your hands? And Pam, oh yeah, welcome. Pam Blumberg is here with ladies from Bellingham. Welcome to you. And I know Allison Coons is here from Calvary Fellowship. Where is she? Welcome. Anybody else here from Calvary Fellowship? Where else are we from? Who am I missing? Seattle? Great, well, welcome. We're glad to have you here. West Seattle, wonderful. Raymond, oh yeah, that's right. You guys drove quite a ways, didn't you? I don't know where Raymond is. I've lived here all my life. I'm sorry. My geography is horrible. This is funny too. I was going to try to fit this in somewhere, and I actually told Pam, I said, if I don't speak about this in my second session, just, you know, I was going to make her stand up and yell at me or something, but I can't stand it. It really doesn't fit anywhere here today, but I'm going to tell you anyway, because I can't stand it. I can't wait one more minute. I got back from France 2 weeks ago. I did a women's conference there with Kathy Taylor for three of our Calvaries in France, Nice, Paris, and Lyon. And then there were ladies there from Italy, and there were people there from all over the world. It was the most international gathering I've ever been a part of, and it was wonderful. But I have just been bursting to be in front of a group of women so I can tell you this, because I met women there from Iran and from Somalia, and they were Muslim. They were raised Muslim. And have you heard about how the Lord is reaching the Muslim world by speaking to them in dreams? I've heard it too, and now I've met them. I was so excited. These women were just nonchalantly over lunch in broken English and through an interpreter, because I wanted all the details, telling me about dreams that they'd had. They were fully Muslim, raised Muslim, had never heard the word of Jesus, the name of Jesus, other than maybe in whispers that you're not ever supposed to talk about Jesus. And he appeared to them in dreams. And I met two women who told me their story. And then the one woman, Ismahan, told me that her brother, she was one of 18 children. And her father fathered eight with her mother and then went off to have 10 more and was never in the picture much. But they were a very staunch Muslim family. And she'd been praying for her brother, who's still in Somalia. And he called her to tell her that Jesus had appeared to him in a dream. And he was following Jesus. And then this one woman told me about someone she knew. So you're hearing it fourth hand or whatever that is. But I still believe her. I don't think she'd lie to me. But she told me about a woman she knows who was Muslim. And I believe also in Iran. And she had a stroke. And then half of her body was paralyzed. She was in bed. Her face and one side, she couldn't move at all. While she was in that state, she thought she was sleeping, thought she was having a dream, that Jesus walked in the room and touched her face. And she opened her eyes and she was healed. And she got up off her bed and started to walk out the door. And her husband in the other room said, "Who just opened and shut the front door?" Oh, I just love that story. I know. Isn't the Lord amazing? So back to our regularly scheduled conference. No. Seriously, I'm like, I got to fit that in somewhere. But really, it does fit with our worship song, because as we were singing, "Your love knows no bounds or has no bounds," I thought, that's a perfect story. In a world where you are beheaded for speaking of Jesus, he's not thwarted by that. He just shows up in the night. I love that about the Lord, and I love knowing that we all belong to him and that he's doing a work. He's doing a work today. The other song that I was writing the lyrics to, "Rid Me of Myself, I Belong to You." I love that song, and that really is what we're here today to talk about. We want to be rid of all the things in us, all the baggage, all the weight that keeps us from honoring God with our contentment. A little intro, as you heard, I am a pastor's wife and a writer and an editor, and I'm really blessed beyond anything I can ever say to write for Pastor Chuck and Kay. It keeps me very busy, but it's almost like not work. It's like I get to just sit all day long reading their teachings. It's like an all-day devotional all the time. I'm very blessed to do that. But if I were writing a resume, I was thinking about this, it would go something like this. It would say, experienced in pain, lost mother to suicide, diagnosed with infertility, 13 failed adoptions, murder of a young friend, has endured rejection, abandonment, and slander, and references can be provided upon request. And you're thinking, what job is she applying for? But I actually already have the job for which all of those things are most important, and that is pastor's wife. And I know Pam is here, and Anna is here, and Wink, and the other ladies, I don't know your names, I'm sorry, from Seattle necessarily. Maybe I do, and I just don't know it. But just stand for a moment, if you're a pastor's wife, and you're here. I want us to all see you. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Now, I'll tell you something about us. In God's wisdom, he very seldom uses someone that he has not marked or wounded in some way. And I don't say that in a bad way. I'm very thankful for all the scars I have, and I know these ladies are too. But the fact is, as your pastor's wives, we would not be any good to you at all if we had not made a lot of bad choices in our lives and been forgiven a whole bunch and gotten a giant eyeful of grace. That's the reason the Lord let us be pastor's wives, because we have done all the things you shouldn't do, and he's forgiven us. So just don't think that we're any different from you. We just probably did a whole lot more than what you have ever done. I can speak for myself. I have that story. Every awful choice that I ever made, though, God has used in ministry. He's used it to make me approachable to those who struggle with guilt and shame. And every abandonment and betrayal that I've suffered, mostly as a pastor's wife, I will say, has helped me to identify more fully with Jesus. And every tear that I've shed over the losses of the people I love and the disappointments has helped me to share that comfort that God gave me with those that are also crying or in grief. He's been very, very faithful to bring the lessons. Hi, Tammy. Oh, my Tammy's here. Sorry. We had to lose Tammy to Bellingham, and you're welcome. But it was for a good reason. She got married and gained a daughter and now a baby son that I can't wait to see. So I'm sorry. I'm going to have to abbreviate this lesson, but no. Oh, he's beautiful. He's so beautiful. I'll be holding him later. One of the lessons that God brought, we've been a church for about 15 years. In June, it'll be 15 years. And one of the lessons he started back then, and I'm still learning it, but it began then, was how to be contented. Because prior to that, I was a very, very discontented woman. I wasn't aware that I was. I mean, I don't think we know it when we're that way. But the truth was, I was a discontented, murmuring, ungrateful woman. And I was sinning against the Lord in doing so. And if you are murmuring or complaining or ungrateful today, you are sinning. And I don't like being the bearer of bad news, but I would be doing us a disservice if I candy-coated it. If I said, oh, it's just a little murmuring, just use your sweet voice, dear. I mean, it doesn't. There's no sweet voice when we're murmuring against the Lord, because we are murmuring against the Lord. If in this life we're disappointed or our expectations haven't been met, and we either verbalize that to the Lord, we verbalize it to each other, or just internally we talk to ourselves about it, we are making some really horrific statements, and we have to look at these. What we are saying when we complain about anything is that God is not sovereign. We may tell people that we think he is, because we know the language as Christians, and so we say those things, but if we believe he's sovereign, why are we fighting against what he permitted? We are also making the statement that God is not good. This might be the worst of all, because he is good. And when we have that demeanor that says, life is not going the way I want it to, we're really making a very loud declaration that we don't trust his goodness, that he's not good. We're also saying that he's not wise. We might tell people we think he's wise, but if we believed it, we would wait out our circumstance to see what he's doing in it. And we would not let our hearts clutch the notion that we have a better way. Because even if we never actually form those words out loud, when we are complaining against what God has permitted, we are saying we know better. That's what we're doing. We're also saying that God is not powerful. We might tell people he's powerful, but why then do we not trust his ability to intercede for us or to bring good out of the situation? Discontentment is a sin. And look what it got Miriam. You remember Miriam and Aaron complained against Moses. And the word tells us that they were complaining against him marrying the Ethiopian woman. But they really weren't complaining about that. That was an excuse, because Miriam said, has God spoken only by Moses? Has he not spoken by us too? So it was a jealousy issue. And the Lord heard and he didn't like it. And his anger was kindled against Miriam, and she was leprous for 7 days. She woke up with leprosy. Even though Moses went and interceded for her, the Lord had her waited out 7 days to show her, stop murmuring against the leadership. It is also a sin to be ungrateful for what you've been given. and probably you think as I do right away, of the children of Israel, when God had rescued them from slavery, he had provided all the food they could ever need, and the worst they had to do was bend over and pick it up in the morning. It was just right there. How many of you would like that? Breakfast is ready, kids. Here, just bend down, you know. And yet, they allowed themselves to get a hankering for the meat that they had had in Egypt, where they were slaves. I mean, I can't imagine longing for anything that came out of that. But they did. And the Lord heard. And what we read in Numbers 11, the very first line of the chapter said, "Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord." So we could pretty much stop right there and be done, because we don't have to read further. Murmuring, complaining, displeases the Lord. And of course, the rest of the chapter tells us what their complaining got them. God says, "You want meat? All right." And he sent clouds upon clouds of quail that just fell dead at their feet. And the word tells us that the ones that were really clamoring after meat picked it up and started eating the quail, and it rotted in their teeth. And they died, the ones that ate it. And this is the reason I don't eat quail, right here, right there. Plus, it's never been offered to me. I hope it never is. It was wrong for the children of Israel to be discontented, and it is even wronger, if I could create a word, more wrong, for a child of God that came through the sacrifice of Jesus to ever complain about anything. Because when we do that, we are not giving the right witness to the world. We're not telling them of the goodness of the God who redeemed us. We're all, actually, when we do that, we're also telling them that our God doesn't love us. When you complain about anything, you're saying he's not taking care of you. In this session and the next two, we're going to talk about the three main causes of discontentment. Now, I know that we're talking about contentment in our time today, but in learning the three causes of discontentment, you're going to learn the way to be content. So I want to look at discontentment for one main reason, and that's because it's our natural state. It's our default attitude. You don't have to do anything to be discontented. Just be. It's not like you have to try. And I say that because listen to what Paul says in Philippians 4:11. And I know you ladies from Linwood have been studying contentment, so no doubt you've gone over this verse a lot. "For I have learned in whatever state I am to be content wherewith." We start out as discontented creatures. And you might have observed that in the small people in your life, the little ones. A wonderful thing happened to me 16 months and a couple weeks ago, and I became a grandmother for the first time. It's the greatest thing ever. And Anna has 5 children. Does anybody have more than 5 children in the room? Just curious. Not to single you out. But I know how much work it is. I just want to tell you, there is a reward coming. Being a grandmother is a reward for all the hard parts of being... Can I just get an amen from that, from the grandmothers? Is it not the greatest thing you've ever done? I just think this is the role for which I was born. We are the sayer of yes. You want a cookie? Yes, my darling. Yes, you may stay up late. Whatever. I just see all these yeses coming. I just love that boy so much. And everything he does is cute to me, even when he's really being a stinker. I just laugh. It's not my job. I love that so much. My son goes, why do you like being a grandma more than you like being a mom? I go, because the buck doesn't stop with me. I just get to love him, hug him, see what you're going to do about his little attitude. Do anything. It really is. Oh, I just can't wait for more and more. But Gage, my grandson, he is so spoiled rotten because he's the first grandchild on either side of the families. That we went out, I could not get my husband to let me have a coffee table because our living room is narrow in the wood stoves there. But when Gage came along, I used Gage as leverage that doesn't leave the room. Honey, Gage needs a toy chest. Do you not see how many toys are all over the floor? Yes, Dave says, we must go buy the grandson a toy chest. So I got a nice coffee table toy chest. And it's all padded, you know. And it's stuffed with toys. I mean, it's so full of toys. It's huge. And it's so full of toys, we can't shut the lid. Now, that boy will be playing with one of these expensive toys, and I will walk in with a straw. And Gage has to have the straw. Or a receipt. Or hand lotion in a tube. And if I don't hand him those things, which of course I do because I'm grandma, but if somebody else doesn't hand him those things, he collapses in a dramatic heap to demonstrate that we have destroyed his life. We are born discontented creatures. It's just who we are. We don't have to try. You don't have to try to be that. Paul himself was never the poster child for contentment. If you think about his personality, he was hot-headed, impulsive, irritable, and very, very driven. Paul was not this go-with-the-flow, peaceful guy before Jesus. So we can see, looking at that, that contentment is not a personality issue. It's not like, oh, well, she's just very contented and she's just not. None of us are until we learn it. Contentment is a learned art. And like any art, you have to work at it. You have to make mistakes and you have to learn from those mistakes. And then we look at the next part of Paul's statement. In whatever state I'm in, Paul is saying that no matter what happens to me, I've learned to be content. And another way to say that is Paul has learned to be emotionally independent of his circumstances. Now, for some people, that might not be such a big deal, but you know the circumstances of Paul's life, don't you? You know that he was shipwrecked, not just once. He bobbed in the ocean for a day and a half. He was beaten time and time and time again, scourged, actually. And sometimes people died from one scourging, and Paul received it five times. He was, it just goes on and on and on. Just the little bit we've talked about shows you that it was not an easy statement to say, I've learned, in whatever, no matter what happens to me, I've learned to be content. That's a very bold statement. Now, Jeremiah Burroughs was a Puritan who was born in 1599, and he said the same thing. He said, Christian contentment is that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. It's simply yielding to the much greater wisdom and power and sovereignty of God than we will ever have, ever. Our little puny thoughts and our little tiny agendas cannot compare to the beautiful thing the Lord's trying to do in us, and we just yield. So again, contentment is learned, it's an art, and it's a character trait that cannot be touched by our circumstances. And it really is the difference between a full life and an empty life. And the first foe in this session of contentment, the first habit, if you will, that has to be corrected is our perspective. This is one of the things that causes discontentment. This year, I saw two very, very stark contrasts in how some people handled some situation and saw the difference that perspective makes in a life. The first one is the one I don't even like sharing, but I have a friend who was at our church years ago, and then she moved to South Carolina, and she's kept in touch. And she will often call us and run things by us. Well, she went to this little church in South Carolina, and from everything we heard at first, she loved the church, loved the fellowship, loved the pastor, loved everything about it. But this year, she called me with some real big concerns. And as she was telling me the story, I was getting concerned. Her pastor lives on acreage in South Carolina, and he got involved in the prepper movement. And you guys know what that is, the prepper movement? They're preparing for the end of the world, I tell you. I mean, it's like, because we could have a polar shift any moment, or we could have an asteroid hit the Earth, or there could be a gas shortage, or the economy could go further. It doesn't matter. If there's a show on cable, National Geographic's Preppers, and every time they show it, they highlight two or three different people, and all of them have a different reason for why they think the world's coming to an end. But they do everything. Their whole entire life is now given over to getting prepared. So this pastor started training his children how to shoot a gun. He lined up with another person from the church, and they booby-trapped all the acreage. They began figuring out how to do alternative sources for heat and energy. They stockpiled over 10,000 pounds of food for their two families, and it all became about that. And then one day he just walked into the church and resigned and said that he was closing that church and they were not to meet there anymore. And then he threatened to sue my friend and the rest of the church if they tried to keep meeting as a church. And now he's a consultant for National Geographic's Prepper Show. This is a man who answered a call to save souls. And now the focus of his life is to save his family should an asteroid hit the Earth. It's almost funny, except it's so horrific. His perspective has been lost. He doesn't have the right perspective anymore. It's not about heaven for him. And I think that's about one of the most shameful things I could ever tell a group of people. A pastor walked away to preserve his family. I can't relate to it. But I'll tell you who has not lost their perspective, who has a wonderful perspective, and that's the Haitian church. Our church has gone three times, my husband's gone three times, and I got to go in November for my first trip, and I fell in love with the Haitians. I love the Haitians, and especially I love the Haitian church. You just have never seen joy like you see in those people. And what's amazing to me is that in the mountains, they're starving. But even down near, we go to Jacmel, which is right on the water. Even in Jacmel, they don't have a great amount of money. And they have not recovered from the earthquakes. Port-au-Prince, the airport, when you fly in, there's still cracks. All the windows still have tape on them, and there's cracks in the walls of the airport. It's like nothing has been done. And when we were there in November, it was, I don't do well with heat. You know, it gets above 75, and I kind of feel woozy. You know, I'm just one of those. And I had a team of people praying against the heat for me. Please, that's my only prayer request. And sure enough, you know, I was just a sheet of sweat the whole time we were there, but I didn't care. But it was so funny. I'd be like, if I was wearing this dress, about 5 minutes after I ran, got to a place, all my tissues would be gone. I'd just start going, just like, it was just horrible. There's a visual for you. Take that one to lunch. No. So, sorry about that. Hope we're not having quail. No. So we're in this place. We're in church, actually, and everyone is just beautiful, and they really dress up. They put a lot of effort into what they're wearing. And we found out they walk to church, most of them, because not everybody has a car, but everybody has a phone. I will say that worldwide, everybody has a cell phone. But these women were just gorgeous, and the men's shirts were blazingly white. I mean, hurt your eyes white. We're in this gigantic church. There's fans all over the ceiling, and not one of them works, or someone forgot to turn them on. For the love of all that's decent, I'm praying, turn on the fan. You know, that's what I'm thinking, but I'm not saying it. And I actually was woozy that time. I was so hot. Nobody complains. None of them. They're just so joyful. And the service is like 3 hours long. And then these people get up after a three-hour service, and they walk the 3 or 4 miles back to the tent they live in. And in order to get their husband's shirts clean for the next service, they boil them for 2 days every week. And you've never seen people so contented, so full of joy. I want what they have. My first thought was, we're going to go. We're going to bring giant suitcases. We're bringing home a lot of kids. You know, we're going to rescue these poor children in poverty. I would not bring a Haitian child to America ever, because what they have is so much more beautiful. The boys and the girls, the little ones, the brothers walk down the street with their arms around their sisters. They are tender to each other. In the orphanages, the older ones, meaning the six-year-olds, care for and hold the little babies. It's just a beautiful thing. So those were two differences in perspective. When we are looking up and we realize that this is just the warm-up for the actual event, do we realize that? Life is just the warm-up. Then nothing can really touch our peace. But if we're looking down and we're looking at each other and we really do think life is all there is, then we probably should all have brand new cars all the time. Because if this life is all there is, don't we deserve a new car constantly? And I think plastic surgery is a swell idea, if this life is all there is. I do. I'm into it if this life is all there is. I think if this life is all there is, we all need gigantic houses, purposeful furniture, we should hire a decorator. But this life is not all there is. This is just a blip. When I was trying to teach my son what eternity was, because he asked, you know, they ask these questions, you're like, hang on, I just need a second, you know. The Lord just gave it to me, and I said, well, honey, if we were out in a giant boat in the middle of the ocean, and we had one of your tears, and it fell overboard, would you ever be able to find it again? He goes, no. I go, would you want to? He goes, no. And that was just the Lord, you know. I go, well, that's life. Life's a teardrop. Eternity's the ocean. It doesn't really matter what happens here, does it? It's gone like that. So we have to stop thinking I have to have this and that and the other. That's the wrong perspective. I have to save my family, learn to shoot, stockpile some tomato soup. You know, that's the wrong perspective. If this life is everything, then it stands to reason that I must always be happy and you must always be happy. And woe to anyone who does not make us happy, because we're just going to walk away from them. That's really what happens, you know, a lot of times. And I, as a pastor's wife, I've heard many, many times, I have to be happy. He hasn't made me. She hasn't made me happy for a very long time. I have to be happy. No, you do not. There's a lot of happiness coming up ahead, over the hill. This is not what this is about. I started out my married life with a good perspective. As a young bride, I put this little index card on my fridge, and it said, if I need it, God will provide it. If I don't have it, I must not need it. And it served me really well for about 2 years. Yeah, maybe not quite. Maybe it was like a year and a half. But then things began to happen outside of my control. My mother did commit suicide. I couldn't stop her from doing that. I got a diagnosis of being infertile. and it killed me because I wanted 10 children. We tried and failed 13 times to adopt between our son and our daughter. We did have two, but 13 times we failed. And in my mind, all of that was happening apart from God's vision. I could not believe that God was seeing that. How could this happen if he saw it? Doesn't he know I need to be happy, was my attitude. And then we were actually at a church that's here in Linwood, but we had joined the church. We were brand new. Nobody knew our situation. Nobody knew I was grieving so terribly. And we joined the worship team, and my husband said, let's go to the worship retreat just to get to know people. And so we went, and I can't emphasize enough, nobody there knew us. Nobody knew anything about us. But we're standing, and John Corson was our keynote speaker. And this wasn't a Calvary Chapel. We didn't even know what Calvary Chapel was. We didn't know where he came from. But my husband roomed with him, and honestly, I think that's why he's a pastor today. Because you don't room with John Corson and not become a pastor. I mean, it just doesn't happen. Dave just peppered him with questions. How do I know God like you do? You know, and John says, well, he goes, wear out your Bible every year, read the classics, you know, great advice. So we're at the Saturday night bonfire, and John had said, I want you to take the thing that matters the most to you that's keeping you up at night and that you can't let go of and write it on a piece of paper, and when you're ready, just throw it in the fire and commit it to the Lord. And I, of course, I wrote, I want a baby, and then I shoved it in my pocket. I'm not throwing that in any fire. I don't care who you are. Don't ask me to burn my desire. And my husband probably wrote the same thing, and he burnt his. And then peer pressure. Oh, it's horrible. You know, my husband's looking at me like, where's your paper, you know? So I reach in, I throw it in there, and the whole time I'm like, let me have a baby, let me have a baby, let me, as it's burning, you know. So we're standing there, and people start sharing what's hurting them. And I hear this one woman says, I just found out I have skin cancer. And everybody hugged her and prayed for her. Another man says, I'm not over my divorce, I'm really grieving. And then a voice that was really familiar said, my wife can't have a baby. I was like, I know that voice. You know, why is he telling people this? But the woman right next to me said, I'm infertile too. And she hugged me and I wept. And we cried together. And it was just this beautiful thing happened at the campfire where we bonded as a church family and as friends. And so the next morning, it was a completely different scenario. I knew him. They knew me. It's Sunday. You know, I can't wait to see him Wednesday at worship practice. Now, all this time, I'm thinking, I am in terrible pain and God does not know. Because if God knew, surely I would not be in terrible pain because he wants me to be happy, right? This was my attitude. So Sunday night, you know, we all go home to our families, and I don't see them till Wednesday at worship practice. I get in there, I walk in the door, and I think her name was Mary. My husband remembers it as something different, but I remember her son's name. She goes, I have to talk to you right now. She pulls me out in the hall. And then as though to convince me, she goes, I didn't know you before last weekend, did I? I go, no, no. I never knew anything about you, right? I go, no, that's correct. You did not. She said, I went home on Sunday, and I'm tucking in my boys, my six-year-old, my four-year-old. And I'm asking them about their weekend, and did you have fun at grandma's, blah, blah, blah. She goes, and I go to tuck in my four-year-old, Brian. And he says to me, Mom, is there a woman in your choir named Shannon? She goes, yeah, there is. I met her this weekend. He goes, does she want a baby? She goes, yes, she does. He goes, oh, because I've been asking Jesus every night to bring her a baby. I can hardly tell that story ever without just being in awe that God spoke through a four-year-old. God gave a four-year-old boy a word of knowledge for me. And it was like the Lord appeared next to me and whispered, I see. I'm here. It did something to me to know that. The next Sunday, I asked to meet him. And I bent down and said, please don't stop. And 5 months later, I came back to church with our son, who we had just adopted. And Brian was the first person that I introduced him to. And I knew God loved me. And I was a contented woman for about 2 years. And then, through a whole series of events, I had surgery to correct my infertility. And I was all excited because the doctor said, no problem, you'll be pregnant in no time. And I'm the oldest of three sisters. And I always did everything first, right? So I'm going to break ground here. I'm going to be the first one to be able to tell them what pregnancy's like. And nothing happened. And a couple months later, my second to the youngest sister announced that she was pregnant. And it just devastated me. I wasn't going to be able to lead her in that. It wasn't the way it was supposed to be. And then the ugliness really began because I could not provide a sibling for my son. He was the joy of my life, but he wanted and needed siblings, and I couldn't do it. I was broken. The cat could get pregnant. I was resentful of my cat. I was. I was angry at every birth mother who changed her mind, because they all changed their minds. I was so angry. And my neighbor, I was mad at my neighbor when she announced she was pregnant again, because I loved her daughter with little curls. And then her husband came over a few nights later and said, "Can I tell you something?" He said, "Nancy miscarried this morning." And I'm looking at Walt, and I'm thinking three things rapidly: relief and jealousy, because she can just go right back out and get pregnant again, and shame at the ugliness I had just caught in my heart. And I just wept. I was folding towels when he walked in, and I put my face in the towel because I was so ugly, and I had seen it. And Walt's like, "We'll be all right. We'll be all right." Not knowing, I'm weeping at my own hideousness. And I'm thinking, well, you guys will, but I don't know if I will, because there's this hot, red-hot volcano of hateful lava in me, and when's it going to spill over next? This is how I felt. So I decided one more time to trust one more birth mother. She promised she would not hurt me, and this was like maybe the seventh or eighth time we had tried. And she had the baby. I had named him Cameron. Her mother called me and said, "Noah is just perfectly healthy." I'm like, "Who's Noah?" And she had named him, and I wasn't too happy about that. And also that she'd taken a whole day before she told me. So we went up to Anacortes and went to the hospital, walked into the nursery. I bonded with that baby instantly. I just cried when I saw him, just like I did with my son, Zach. It was like that same instant connection. And I'm holding him, and we're taking pictures, and I'm just touching his little face, and he's looking right at me. And don't tell me they don't see you. They see you. He's looking right at me like, "There you are. Yes, I'm here." You know, it was this beautiful moment. And the phone rang in the nursery. And the nurse went over in the corner to pick it up. Nothing in her body language said anything to me, but I knew I was not taking that baby home with me. And she turned around, and she put the phone down. She said, "Give me the baby. His mom's coming for him." And it was like God was so gracious. I mean, I didn't see it at the time, but he slowed time enough that I could kiss the baby once and pray over him quickly before they took him from me. And it was like, it was worse than a death, because my baby was out there somewhere, and his 19-year-old mother, who had written to me saying, "I just want you to know, no worries, I still get to go to college because I found a great daycare just down the street." And I'm thinking, daycare? I would stare at this baby all day long, and so would his brother. And I was crazy. I was losing my mind. I would sit there and I would pray, "God, make him colicky. God, just make him miserable." You know, I wanted him to cry all night long. I wanted to show her it's not easy. And I prayed that and prayed that and prayed that. Well, we had written back and forth, and I had asked her if I could send a quilt that I was making for him. I had almost finished it. And I wanted it because I believed that she was not taking care of him and that he was cold. This was my great fear, that she was just off. She wanted to be a pilot, and I thought, she's off there somewhere. You know, he's alone and cold and missing me. And I would hold it and just pray that my scent was in the fibers and that he would recognize it. It was this little black and red quilt, because I had been a teacher, and in my studies, they talked about the vibrant colors, you know, that they like black and white, or they like sharp contrast. So I picked all this fabric so that it would be very interesting to him, and soft flannel, and there are always little cows and pigs and this one little pattern. It was just so cute, so farmish, because we have a little kind of hobby farm. And then on the black squares, I was taking red embroidery thread and embroidering a barn, a red barn. And I kind of knew I was losing my mind when I was sitting by the window one day, and I was embroidering, and I just thought, when Cameron comes home, we should build a big red barn. And I thought, what is happening to me? And I burst into tears, and I said, "Why, God?" It was the first time I ever asked why. I didn't even ask why over my mom, and that was the greatest grief to me. But I said, "Why?" All my friends have their mothers, and I hated them for that. That's the word. I hated them for that. All my friends have more children than they want. Nothing ever happens to anyone but us. Why? Why? And I was sitting there just sobbing and looking out our front window into our little, we call it the orchard, but there's eight trees out there. But to the right of it is this little shed that my husband has his tools and stuff in, and we have a couple freezers out there. And on the left, I had painted delphiniums and hollyhocks, and it's old and weathered. There's moss all over the ceiling. It's just a really cute little shed, but it's full of junk. And there's one board was kind of hanging off a nail, so you could see in. It was just black in there. And it's far. I mean, it's like three or four times what the building was. I was looking, what we are here, I was looking across this little field, maybe twice. I exaggerate. And I'm sitting there, and I'm just going, why, Lord? And the Lord gave me a vision. And I've had a few of them, and they're not like, I always thought, you know, harp music would play, and your eyes would go all movie soft around the edges, you know. But it's not really like that. You just see stuff, you know. So I'm like, here we go. No, but I'm sitting in the chair, and the Lord just took me right through into the shed. It's like he and I went in the shed, or he put me in the shed. And all of a sudden, in this little room, and it's small. It's like from where I am, smaller than from here to the speaker, and maybe that wide. And nothing was in it now that's in it. But what I saw was one light that hung over a wood carver's table, like a table like in wood shop in high school or junior high, whenever we did that. And in the corner, there was a man with his back to me, and he was holding a piece of wood. And the light was shining down on him, but I couldn't see him yet. And in the four corners of this little room, I saw these bundles of 2x4s. They were like if you went down to the lumber yard and you bought 2x4s. And they were just straight as could be. Some had knots and stuff, but nothing, just straight raw lumber. And they were all gathered with twine around them, one bundle in each of the four corners. And I knew they had been there a long time because there were spider webs all over them and dust. They were just, nobody touched them forever. And then I looked again at the man that was bent over the wood, the table. And it's like I came and I looked over his shoulder, and he had one of those 2x4s in his hand, but he'd had it in his hand for a while, and he had a knife. He was carving away on the wood. There was just a pile of wood chips and sawdust at his feet where you could see all the places that he'd cut away. And the thing was, the part that he'd already dealt with here was exquisitely beautiful, and it told a story. It was like I just wanted to stand there and stare at it. It just told the story. And then the part that he was working on was still plain and untouched. And I looked again. I had just been saying, why, Lord? And I looked again at those four untouched bundles of wood and at the one he was holding. And when he turned around, I knew it was the Lord, but it wasn't like I could see his face. And he just said, you are the wood in my hands. And in a flash, I got my answer to why. And I realized in that instant, it is so much better to be in the hands of the master wood carver, having a story be formed in your life, than to be lying in a corner collecting dust. And never again did I ask him why for anything that happened. I want a story in my life. You want a story in your life. And when we're discontented because this person has hurt us, that was just a little nick in the wood. When we can't have children, that's a huge nick, but it's still part of the story. When we're overlooked, God's carving. He's making beauty out of our lives, and we need not fold our arms and murmur and complain and be discontent. He does not deserve that. Let's pray. Father, you are the master wood carver. And what I see in this room, Lord, is a whole collection of women, each of whose lives tells another part of your story. And some of us might have yielded more readily to your knife because we've seen that. And others are just kicking against the goads and they're digging their feet in and they're unhappy about it. But Lord, you've called us together for this day, for this purpose, that all of us would leave here submitted, yielded, excited, trusting women. And so, Father, I pray that you will do whatever work needs to be done. Let your words, Lord, pierce our hearts, that we will leave here not unchanged, but changed. We'll leave here ready to go out, Lord, and be an example to all of the joy and the peace that comes when we are contented in our Jesus. We ask it in the most beautiful name, your name, Jesus. Amen.